White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to our program tonight on the 4th of July, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hatting Scott.
And are you celebrating our Independence Day, Hatting?
I'm hoping that none of the flying, flaming projectiles touch my dwelling. That's what I'm hoping.
Well, that's good. At least you're aware of it. You know, I think the people of our fair country are probably less independent now than we have ever been, even before the Revolutionary War. What kind of independence are we celebrating anyway? I'd like to celebrate independence from Israel.
Well, you know, George III, he really wasn't all that bad.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there are arguments for that. We might have been better off. Who knows? Although Britain's not better off, so I guess not. I don't know. Yeah. You never know if these wars didn't take place, what would have happened. You don't know the road not traveled. But anyway, we're certainly not very independent in this country, and we will be covering that again tonight in this really good chapter, chapter 49. About Bolshevism in the United States, Jewish, of course, and how it centered in the needle trades or in the garment workers unions in New York with all these imported Jews that came in to fill these things. So it's very interesting, and I'm anxious to get going with it.
All right. Chapter 49. Jewish hotbeds of Bolshevism in the U.S. Bolshevism is working in the United States through precisely the same channels it used in Russia and through the same agents. Revolutionary and predatory unionism, as distinct from business and uplift unionism. And Jewish agitators. When Martens, the so-called Soviet ambassador, left the United States after being deported, he appointed as the representative of Bolshevik Sovietism in the United States one Charles Recht, a Jew, a lawyer by profession, who maintained an office in New York. This office is the rendezvous of all the Jewish union leaders in New York, some of the labor leaders throughout the country, and occasionally of one or two American government officials known to be henchmen of Jewish aspirations in the United States and sympathizers with predatory radicalism.
And just notice that fellow's name is German. There were so many Jews have German names. I don't know if they're all German Jews. I don't believe there's any such thing as a German Jew, but, you know, the ones that call themselves that. But anyway.
Well, you know, actually, German Jew, in its original meaning, it meant German-speaking Jews, which is the same as Ashkenazi Jews, which means Yiddish-speaking Jews.
Well, that's what we should, I should remember to call them that, German-speaking Jews.
Yeah, but then you have, you know, another meaning for this term, German Jews, which is Jews from Germany. Completely different meaning.
Well, Jews born in Germany.
Yeah.
That's what I was calling them, a Jew born in Germany, rather than a German Jew.
Ashkenazi supposedly actually means German. Just like
Sephard.
Sephard means Spanish, supposedly.
Yeah. I don't know how all those Jews got into Germany and then went east from there. That has never made any sense to me.
Supposedly they came up through Italy.
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to be 1,000 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they resided in Germany for a while, and then they spread out east from there.
Yeah.
Taking the German language with them, because it was a useful language for commerce. You know, there was the Hanseatic League.
Right.
It was German.
Right. And then their Yiddish is based on German.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe. So this guy was one of those.
The situation in New York is important because from that center lines of authority and action radiate to all the cities of the United States. New York is the laboratory in which the emissaries of the revolution learn their lesson, and their knowledge is being daily increased by the counsel and experience of traveling delegates straight out of Russia. The American does not realize. Oops, just a second.
Well, I like those words right there. You know, I have that in bold because, you know, the American does not realize. And now he's going to tell us what we don't realize. And this is really important.
Yeah, I just hit the wrong button, but I got it back now. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. The American does not realize that all the public disturbances of which he reads are not mere sudden outbreaks, but the deliberately planned movements of leaders who know exactly what they are doing. Mobs are methodical. There is always an intelligent core which gets done under the appearance of excitement what had been planned beforehand. Up through the German Revolution, up through the French Revolution, up through the Russian Revolution came the previously chosen men, and to this day, in all three countries, the groups thus raised to power have not lessened their hold, and they are Jewish groups. Russia is not more Jew-controlled than is France, and Germany, with all her so-called anti-Semitism, tries in vain to loosen the grip of Judah from her throat.
Well, now, here I think it's important that they are portraying this as a planned, deliberately planned, movement and with a deliberate outcome that they want to bring about and methodical. So, again, it fits into what they believe about the, why they like the protocols of the learned elders. Because it describes that this as a conscious plan that's been put in place, and I think they can make it. Anybody can make a good argument for it that this is exactly right. That what happened in New York with these unions was not accidental. It didn't just happen because this is the nature of these people meeting up with this country in this situation, but that it was all set up to happen that this would be a way to take hold. That's what they're saying. Excuse me. This would be a way to take hold, to get power in this country, to get started.
It is this fact of prepared disorder which makes the New York situation of interest today, because its lines of influence and authority reach everywhere throughout the country. For that reason, and before showing how the Jewish organizations advance Bolshevism and revolution in the United States, the first step will be to describe the condition and extent of the Hebrew labor movement. Most New Yorkers remember the Save Fifth Avenue movement. Save Fifth Avenue.
But also the Hebrew labor movement, they really had it. It was really called that. There was a large, I don't know, I have it in a picture. They have a big banner. You know, the Hebrew, I don't know if it was Hebrew labor movement, but it was something like that, but it was Hebrew. So that's what they called their, one of their biggest unions.
Okay.
Or maybe groups of unions. Okay.
Most New Yorkers remember the Save Fifth Avenue movement, that avenue from 14th to 34th Street, with sections of Broadway, is historic ground. It is wrought into the history of America in a peculiarly intimate way. A little more than 15 years ago, that would be like 1904, it contained the homes of the older families, the establishments of famous publishers, the stores of art dealers, and the famous shopping center. It was a district known throughout the United States as typifying American substance and good taste. But presently, Americans who thought they were secure in their own city were aware of an advancing shadow. A subtle atmosphere of deterioration became evident. In the top lofts of buildings, sweatshops had been installed, which noon and night poured into the streets an alien stream. Not a glad, hopeful-eyed immigrant rejoicing to be in America and at work, but something darker. It was the Russian and Polish Jew. He swarmed into this district, the most typically American of any outside of Boston and Philadelphia, from the first.
Just think about that, you know. I never think about it that way, but they remind me every so often that New York City was very American. You know, it wasn't full of Jews at that time, and it was, you know, totally different kind of atmosphere there. And they're going to describe here, you know, how they changed it.
Nowhere else would the sweatshops go except in the very heart of goy respectability. There were protests and organizations. Jews were appealed to in the name of the city. They smiled and promised, but like a tide coming in, the invasion swept farther and stronger every week. New Yorkers hesitated to go down into the district to trade, and merchants lost their businesses. Real estate values dropped in consequence. The Jews bought valuable properties at low figures. Today, at noontime, Fifth Avenue is packed from wall to curb with dark, squat figures in masses of thousands. They parade in dense throngs and make the street impassable. They make a strange, un-American atmosphere, Slavonic with some Oriental admixture. Their tongue is alien. Their attitude is one of sullenness mingled with a sense of power. You leave the New York of American meaning whenever you approach that alien throng. They have taken over the district as completely as if they had invaded it with the bayonet.
You think they're exaggerating there? I mean, do you think, is that probably just the way it was, or do you think they're trying to make it sound worse?
Well, you see, they probably aren't exaggerating, but it might be hard for people today, especially if they don't live in New York City, to find this kind of thing credible, because Jews have assimilated to a considerable degree since then. Most of the Jews that most people see today are not as obviously foreign as the Jews that he's talking about here.
Well, right. Now, I was looking up some stuff, and at this site called GothamCenter.org, they had a very interesting section on the garment industry and some of it that I read I thought was really good, because it describes the same thing that they're describing, although this is written by Jews. And this is the way the Jews have created their narrative of this period of time. And I'm going to read this. It won't take too long. They said, in the early years of the 20th century, several changes contributed to the garment industry's move north from the tenements of downtown Manhattan. First, changes in the law no longer allowed manufacturing in residential buildings. Manufacturers had to move out of their homes and into commercial loft buildings. Second, demand for ready-to-wear clothing expanded during these years, especially in women's clothing. Women began wearing dresses rather than skirts and blouses. This led to changes in marketing that required fancy showrooms. Well, I don't know why, but that's what they say. Third, manufacturers wanted to be physically close to the new department stores and other retailers. So that would be Fifth Avenue. In 1906, for example, B. Altman, one of the top New York department stores, today home to the SUNY Graduate Center, C-U-N-Y, College, City University of New York, opened on Fifth Avenue and 34th Street. Then it goes on, it has a picture here of what it looked like. Along with industry came workers, and merchants did not think shoppers wanted to mix with workers, that is, the department store people, didn't think their shoppers were going to like it if they had all these workers in the streets and so on, especially immigrant workers. After a public campaign by the merchants, and most of them were Jewish anyway, but they were, you know, different from the garment makers, manufacturers were forced to move west to less expensive property in a neighborhood known as the Tenderloin that housed a poor community composed mostly of African Americans and Irish immigrants. This community, as so commonly happens throughout New York's history, was displaced to make room for the newly emerging garment district. Finally, in 1918, a subway line began service on Broadway, and the IRT the subway extended service down 7th Avenue, too. And these subway lines brought workers from residences in Brooklyn and Bronx neighborhoods into Midtown. The new subway also offered convenient public transportation for manufacturers, many of whom had grown prosperous and now lived on the Upper West Side, and Penn Station conveniently brought out-of-town buyers directly to the new garment district. The area around the station hosted hotels, theaters, and entertainment venues. Now, I wonder how much the Jews had to do with getting these subway lines and these train lines and so on, where they have put them, you know, to help them out. I bet they had something to do with that.
I bet they did.
Yeah, and then the these out-of-town buyers, you know what out-of-town buyers, what reputation they have when they come to New York to do their work, so they make sure they have entertainment venues where they're going to be. You can imagine what those entertainment venues were like burlesque and pornographic or something, and maybe prostitution and so on. But yeah. Now, the other thing is that they constructed these new garment lofts and showrooms. They multiplied between 1920 and 1928. 120 enormous high-rise manufacturing and showroom buildings were erected north of 35th Street. The other thing is that on the side streets, trucks delivered material and loaded finished garments, frequently blocking traffic. Garments were carted through traffic by pushboys, making life difficult for pedestrians. And at lunch hour from noon to one, workers and bosses flooded local cafeterias and private clubs. Well, again, you know, they pushed their way into there. And then even though it was inconvenient for the people who were there and people, even pedestrians and so on, but, you know, they picture that as, oh, the exciting, thriving, full of lifetime of that period of time with the garment district expanding. But this was all Jews doing this, you know. Later they went past 8th Avenue. Not too much more to say there. So, but I thought that was kind of interesting because it verified what the International Jew is saying pretty much.
Well, sure, they're not making things up here.
No. Right. Yeah, right.
All this would be very hopeful, of course, if we could take and sustain the attitude of the unsophisticated young reader of fiction and regard these people as new Americans. There is a mass of moving stories, mostly written by Jews, by the way, pretending to describe the glowing hearts with which these throngs look out upon America, their intense longing to be American, their love of our people and our institutions. Most unfortunately, the actions of these people and the utterances of their leaders give the lie to this fair picture which, as Americans, we would fain believe. The resistance offered to Americanization, consisting in the limitations put upon the Americanization program, has been sufficient to convince all observers that, so far as the Jewish invasion is concerned, it is not their desire to go the way America is going, but to influence America to go the way they are going.
And isn't that the typical immigration story? Today, it's different immigrants, but they have the same, it's the same thing, you know. They don't want to join. Go ahead.
With Jews, yeah, that's the way it goes, yeah.
Well, it goes that way today with other immigrants.
But that's because of the Jewish influence, you see. They're not trying to assimilate because assimilation is no longer the ideal. It's no longer made practically necessary. They had this problem in Britain when they adopted multiculturalism in the 1960s. There's a documentary, BBC documentary about Enoch Powell, where one of these social scientists that talks about the effect of multiculturalism said, all of a sudden, people who didn't think of themselves as belonging to distinct ethnic groups before, like Greeks, suddenly became a distinct ethnic group. When you reward people for being separate and distinct, they decide that they are that way. And this is the path that's on which we've been put through Jewish influence.
Okay.
They talk a great deal, and also there are just way too many of these Hispanic immigrants. When you bring in a huge number of any population, it always becomes much harder to assimilate.
Oh, sure, that's right. They just go into their enclaves. Right.
They talk a great deal about what they bring to America. Hardly anything at all of what they found here. America is presented to them as a big piece of putty to be molded as they desire, not as a benign mother who is able and willing to make these aliens to be like her own children. The doctrine that the United States is nothing definite as yet, that it is only a free-for-all opportunity to make it what you will, is one of the most distinctive of Jewish political teachings. If it be provincialism to insist that our alien guests become American and cease their endeavors to make America something alien, then there are hundreds of thousands of Americans to plead guilty to provincialism.
That is true. That is considered provincial. You know, if you want the people you live around to be like you, you know, and to be like typical Americans and so on, that is considered now provincial. And, you know, if you're a sophisticated city person, you just love having all these different people speaking different languages, you know, from different nationalities and countries all mixed together there. That's supposed to be, the opposite of provincialism.
Yeah, even though you can't really have a community in a situation like that.
That's right. It's not a community, right? But it looks so, invigorating or something.
There's a lot of stimulation in seeing all kinds of different cultural forms juxtaposed. It's very stimulating, but there's a serious downside to it, which Robert Putnam pointed out, which is that you just can't have a community that way.
Huh.
Of course, Jews, they're not really ever participating in the community as such anyway. They have their own little community, and the multiculturalism doesn't make that any worse for them.
Right.
Just helps them to blend in and not be noticed as a distinct group as much. The melting pot, a term to which Mr. Zangwill gave currency, that's Israel Zangwill, is not a very dignified name for our republic. But aside from that, it is being more and more challenged as descriptive of the process that goes on here. There are some substances in the pot that will not melt. But more significant still, there are rapidly increasing interests who want to melt the pot. So far as Fifth Avenue was concerned, it was the pot that melted. At least, not the most intrepid Jewish leader will shout as much about the American characteristics of the most conspicuous Jewish colony in the world, that of New York. The lofty buildings in this district are filled with clothing workshops, of which the Jew has a monopoly in the United States. Coat makers, pant makers, buttonhole workers, ladies' garment workers, these men are engaged in the needle trades, in which adult men of no other race participate. Why the tendency of the Jew to the needle trades? It is explained by his aversion to manual labor, his abhorrence of agricultural life, and his desire to arrange his own affairs. Arriving in the city of his destination, the Jew would rather not leave it except for other cities. There is one Hebrew society whose charter would indicate that its work is the placing of Jews in the rural districts, but it does next to nothing in this respect. On the other hand, there is testimony that city colonization goes on apace. Widespread Jewish associations are on the lookout for likely towns in which to settle a few Jews, who in time become a larger colony, and in a little longer time, run the place.
Yeah, what about those meatpacking people in Iowa?
Yeah.
Took over that town in Iowa. But I don't know if they got run out or not.
Oh, I'm sure they're still there. There is nothing haphazard about it. The Jew is not an adventurer. He does not cut himself off from his base, but all his movements are made under consultation and direction. He makes sure he's going to be able to get some funding wherever he goes and that he's going to have trade connections and so forth. I think that's what it means.
Yeah.
New York is the great training school in which the newly arrived immigrant receives his instructions as to the method of handling the American goyim. Thus, preferring any kind of a life in the city, and not taking to the trades which involve much bodily effort, the Jew gravitates to the needle, not in the capacity of a creative artist, as is the commercial tailor, but in the production of quantities of ready-to-wear goods. Aside from the white-collar quality of the job, the needle trades appeal to the Jew because at such work he can practically arrange his own hours. For this reason, the Jew generally prefers piecework to day work, domestic industries to factories. He can arrange his own time. Many people wonder how the Jews of New York have so much time for revolutionary consultation, parades, meetings, demonstrations, restaurant debates, and radical authorship. No other class of working people can get the time. Other people work pretty steadily. The explanation is at hand. Extreme socialism and Bolshevism have a great deal of time off. Trotsky, the present head of Russia, lived that way in New York. His main arrangement was for leisure to work up his scheme. All the East Side leaders knew that Trotsky was to take the Tsar's job, even though he never had an extra dollar to spend. There was nothing haphazard about it. It was prearranged, and the appointed men went directly to their pre-appointed places. The east side has other rulers ready now, and they live in the midst of the revolutionary needle trades. One point that should not be overlooked in all this, of course, is that the needle trades being exclusively Jewish, all their abuses are Jewish too. This is said for the benefit of those apologists for Russian Bolshevism, who explain that the reason for it all is the way the poor Russian was treated in America. If Americans will never learn to remember... If Americans will ever learn to remember that the Russian is not a Jew, and that Bolshevism is not Russian but Jewish, and if in addition to that, the American will ever learn to remember that every Russian Jewish laborer in New York comes into contact with a Russian Jewish employer, and every Russian Jew tenant pays his exorbitant rent to a Russian Jew landlord, it will then be clear that once more has the United States been made to bear a slander that does not belong to it.
I like that line. I like that concept there. That can be applied to a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It may be well to remember also that it was on account of these Russian and Polish Jews, while they yet resided in Russia, that the United States broke off her trade treaty with that country. Broke off with the Russia that was a country and a government before America was discovered. And having by that act contributed to the Jewish throttle on Russia through Germany, it is now proposed that the United States, on account of these same Jews, enter into trade agreements with the present Russian tyranny. Verily, the diplomacy of Judah has come very near determining our foreign policy. If they were strong enough, in spite of President Taft's refusal to make us break with Russia, they may also be strong enough to make us shake hands with Bolshevism.
Well, look where we are now with our foreign policy.
Yeah, we're even to the point now that Professors Walt and Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago and Harvard will write about the fact that Zionist Jews pretty much control U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, there you go. Well, good way to put it. And so, you know, it's not Bolshevism, but it's Zionism, what we call today Zionism.
Yeah.
Maybe very similar to the same thing. But it's,
well, these neocons are former Trotskyites. You've got to remember that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's all about globalism, whether it's communists ruling the world or this new global way of making everything one world. It's all the same thing. So as I said earlier, as we started, where's our independence?
Yeah.
You know, we lost that a long time ago.
The Jewish trade union is exclusively Jewish for the reason that the trades affected are exclusively Jewish. That is, the Jewish trade union is not an American trade union. It is not a mixed trade union. It is Jewish. Like all other Jewish activities, the purpose of the trade union is to advance Jewish interests alone. These unions are one aspect of United Israel. This should be borne in mind with reference to the widespread strikes in the clothing trade and the rapid increase in the price of clothing to the 99 million non-Jews in the United States. In spite of all the strikes, the profits advanced enormously. It may be said that the strikes were essential to the advance of the profits, and the country as a whole paid. Look at some of the figures of the needle trades before the war. In the United States, the men's and women's clothing manufactured in 1914 had a value of $932,099,000. In New York alone, 542,685,000 was produced. The rest was produced by the Jewish clothing centers in Chicago, Cleveland, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. The figures for the period of the war and since will be staggering. Clothing in the regular trade began to mount in price until at the end of the war in 1918, it had attained an increase of 200% and 300%. Until well into 1920, the monopoly held up the price. This was done in face of the declaration by the manufacturers of cloth that the whole profiteering persistence was due to the manufacturers of clothing.
See? Now, when the Jews get into something, they push the prices up too. And you know, you get a raw deal all the way around. Even though they manage to pretend, well, you know, in the midst of all this, that they're suffering from these strikers and so on, and so they have to raise some of their prices, but in the end, they've made a fortune, and we have inflation. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Russian Polish Jews in this country only a few months drew $50 to $80 a week.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say that's like $50 a week is probably like $2,000 a week today, which is a lot of money.
When I was a little girl, and it was considered $50 a week, and this was for a long period of time, it stayed that way because we didn't have this kind of inflation. It was just considered, as I recall, that if a family man, a married man with a couple of kids or something, made $50 a week, that was an average, good, you know, salary, decent salary that you could live on. So if they got this all the way back in 1920, that was pretty good. But it is going to say that they had to pay a bunch of it back to the union.
It's probably like $1,000 a week, something like that. Still pretty good money.
Oh, very good. What, for poor people? Poor immigrants?
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Threats of strike were used to get a 5% increase in wages, which was met by a 20% increase in the cost of clothing. The American public paid. If, however, these statements were merely an attempt to arouse indignation that for once the workers got more than they earned, the attempt would be a failure. It is pretty hard to find anyone to regret the workers getting hold of a bonanza. The high wages weren't of much use, as it proved, but people at least had the satisfaction of handling them. These statements are made to show that during the war, the Jewish unions waxed fat, a fact which has a bearing on their Bolshevik attitude today. Not all the wage was the gain of the man who earned it. There was the union to pay. Girls in the fur trade in New York earned $55 a week, of which they paid in $27.50 a week to the unions.
Well, that's exactly half, isn't it?
Yes.
My gosh. I don't think it continued to be that high where people were paying 50% of their income to their wage to the union. That was really something.
Other workers paid in like proportion. There was great talk of what would be done. In Russia, of course, they had the government's gold vaults immediately upon the success of the revolution. But in the United States, the preliminary funds would have to be supplied by themselves. A great revolutionary stroke was planned, of which the written evidence still remains. There are two divisions of Jewish wealth and power centering in New York. The first is German Jewish, represented by the Schiffs, the Spires, the Warburgs, the Kahns, the Lewisons, and the Guggenheims. Mm-hmm. And the Guggenheims. These play the game with the aid of the financial resources of the non-Jews. The other division is composed of the Russian and Polish Jews, who monopolize the hat, cap, fur, garment, and toy trades. By the way, it is the Russian and Polish Jew who control the American stage and movies also. Between them, their grip and influence is far from negligible. They may sometimes have internecine quarrels regarding the division of the profits, and eager publicists may zealously call attention to these quarrels as evidence of the lack of unity among the Jews. But in the Kahila and elsewhere, they understand each other pretty well. And on the question of Jew versus Goy, they are indivisibly one. Between these two forces, the attempt to hold up prices was continued until late in 1920. The heads of the Jewish clothing associations announced that the price of clothing would not be lowered. Solidly behind them were the Associated Hebrew Labor Unions, so-called, which threatened dire things if the prices came down. The first great store to reduce prices in New York was Wanamaker's, a non-Jewish house. In fact, there was no reduction of prices among Jewish manufacturers and merchants generally, until in the month of November, less than a dozen Jews were called into the presence of a non-Jewish financier, after which a belated effort was made to save the buying market by sensational reductions. The Jewish controllers of the clothing business had just previously stated that not only would prices not go down, but the 1921 prices would go still higher. There is a distinction between what the Jewish coalition would do and what it could do. But its will and its power never so closely correspond as when the non-Jewish element is asleep. And never are Jewish will and power so widely divorced as when the non-Jewish mind is alert.
Mm-hmm.
When the non-Jewish financial mind made itself felt in November 1920, the bottom dropped out of Jewish trade prophecies and policies. The only thing to fear is not the alert Jew, but the consequences of sleepiness among the Christians. The Jewish program is checked the moment it is perceived and identified.
Well, I like that sentence. And it's probably true if it really were perceived and identified. Sure, but most people, you still can't get them to perceive and identify. And I think that's a big job that should be undertaken. Anyway, go ahead.
Ordinary people who for 5 years have been paying high tribute to the clothing trust are entitled to know who comprise that trust. But that is a trifling affair compared with the political uses to which the clothing trust has been put in this country. The clothing trust, being composed exclusively of Jews, most of whom have formed the axe head of Jewry in the fight against certain old world governments, is today the heart and center of a movement which, if successful, would leave not a shred of the Republic, its institutions, nor even the liberty, which is every American's by inheritance.
Wow, that's strong.
What is the strength of these people? How are they banded together? What are the facts concerning them? In New York City alone, there are 2,760 Jewish cloak and suit manufacturing concerns, 1,200 Jewish clothing manufacturers, 2,880 Jewish fur manufacturers, 600 Jewish skirt manufacturers, 600 manufacturing tailoring establishments, 800 Jewish merchant tailoring concerns. These employers have organized themselves into associations such as the following. Associated Boys Clothing Manufacturers of Greater New York, Associated Fur Manufacturers, Associated Shirt Manufacturers, Association of Embroidery and Lace Manufacturers, Children's Dress Manufacturers Association, Cloak, Suit, and Skirt Manufacturers Production Association, Cotton Garment Manufacturers of New York, Dress and Waist Manufacturers Association, East Side Retail Clothing Manufacturers Association, Ladies Hat Manufacturers Protective Association, Mineral Water Dealers Protective Association, National Association of Separate Skirt Manufacturers, National Society of Men's Neckwear Manufacturers, New York Association of House Dress and Kimono Manufacturers, New York Tailors Verein, Shirt Manufacturers Protective Association. Among the employed Jews, the unions are numerous, but all gathered up into one central organization. For example, the International Fur Workers Union of the United States and Canada is made up of the following: Feather Boa Makers Union, Fur Cap Makers Union, Fur Cutters Union, Fur Dressers Union, Fur Dyers Union, Fur Floor Walkers Union, Fur Hatters Union, Fur Head and Tail Makers Union, Fur Lined Coat Finishers Union, Fur Nailers Union, Fur Operators Union, Fur Pluckers Union, Muff Bed Workers Union. In the garment industry, the organizations include every operation in the process of making clothes. There are separate unions for buttonhole makers, vest makers, pants makers, coat cutters, coat operators, coat pressers, coat tailors, coat basters, lapel makers, knee pants makers, clothing turners, overall workers, palm beach workers, shirt makers, vest pressers, and even a washable sailor suit union. These together comprise the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. In children's clothing, we have another complete organization: Children's Jacket Makers, three unions, Children's Jacket Pressers, Children's Sailor Jacket Makers Union, Children's Cloak and Reefer Workers Union, Children's Dressmakers Union. In women's wear, there are unions organized around every garment known to the wardrobe, some of which are Amalgamated Ladies Garment Cutters Union, Bonaz Singer and Hand Embroiderers Union, Buttonhole Makers and Button Sewers Union, Children's Cloak and Reefer Workers Union, Cloak and Suit Tailors Union, Cloak and Suit Piece Tailors and Sample Makers Union, Cloak Examiners, Squarers and Bushelers Union, Cloak Makers Union, Cloak Operators Union, Cloak Skirt and Dress Pressers Union, Ladies and Mrs. Cloak Operators Union, Ladies Tailors Alteration and Special Order Union, Ladies Waist and Dressmakers Union, Skirt and Cloth Dressmakers Union, Waterproof Garment Workers Union, White Goods Workers Union, Wrapper Kimono House Dress and Bathrobe Makers Union. These unions comprise the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. That's that group that had the advertisements in the 70s. Look for the union label.
Yeah, they're all, and there's all those different little groups in there.
The reader will have an idea, after reading these lists, that the employees represented in these unions are women. The majority are men. It may require something of an effort to remember that, but it is essential. These organizations control an essential business which, before the war, produced over $1 billion worth of goods a year, and since the war has probably received for its products each year the amount of a big fat Liberty loan. And these unions have received 30-40% of that for wages and propaganda funds.
The people running the unions get 30-40% of this gross take.
Now, let it be said at once that these Jewish unions are not to be confused with the regular labor union movement, as we know it in the United States. They are not Jews who have gone into the American trades unions. They have started unions of their own, which are Jewish in membership, control, and purpose. It is true, of course, that the regular trades union movement, which heads up in the American Federation of Labor, is under the presidency of a Jew, Samuel Gompers, but the membership is mixed, the large majority being non-Jews, and the purpose is not racial. These Jewish unions comprise a body by themselves, and are to be reckoned with not only as labor union groups, but as racial and political groups whose purposes can be determined by the character and utterances of their leaders, as well as by the actions authorized and approved by the unions themselves. Now, this Hebrew union movement is a part of the New York Kehila. Jewish leaders have sought to counteract the Dearborn Independence account of Kehila activities by saying that the Kehila is such a little weak thing. Admittedly, however, the Jewish Clothing Trust and the Jewish Garment Workers Unions are among the biggest and most powerful aggregations in the country. Not even a Jewish leader would have the temerity to deny that. Well, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union are affiliated with the Kehila. More than that, this Kehila, which Jewish spokesmen, with cool contempt for truth, would have the public believe was weak and unimportant, this same Kehila in its executive committee constitutes the American Jewish Committee. Is the American Jewish Committee a non-entity? Ask any president of the United States, any senator or governor. The American Jewish Committee heads up in District Number 12, New York City, and the committee for District Number 12 is also the executive committee of the Kehila. The men who represent before the world the combined organizations mentioned in this article are the Kehila, and they are the American Jewish Committee. And besides, they are the men whose failure in candor has left such an impression of dissatisfaction throughout the masses of the Jewish people. Who are they? Who are these men with whom the Kehila is said to be such a puling thing? Lewis Marshall, of the law firm of Guggenheimer, Untermeyer, and Marshall. Mr. Marshall is not only head of District 12, but he is also head of the American Jewish Committee. His headship of the AJC makes him Jewish leader of the United States. His headship of District 12 makes him head of the New York Kehila. Quite an important man? Yes. And an important place in spite of lying Jewish spokesmen. Who are the others? Eugene Meyer, Jr., formerly of the Capital Issues Committee of the United States War Government. Who else? Judah L. Magnes. Judah L. Magnes is the organizer and active leader of the New York Kehila. The two bodies are linked up again. They are linked up by the Kehila's constitution, which is able to decree that its executive committee shall be the American Jewish Committee as far as District Number 12, New York City, is concerned. There are other names on the American Jewish Committee, which also constitutes the executive committee as the Kehila. Adolf Lewison, Cyrus L. Sulzberger, Felix Warburg, and so on, 36 altogether. In the current annual report of the American Jewish Committee, this relation with the Kehila is acknowledged in a note at the foot of page 123. Just as in the constitution of the Kehila, its relationship with the AJC is acknowledged and explained. Now, to recapitulate, the Hebrew labor unions, both of employees and employers, which are in complete control of the garment industry of the United States, represent one wing of Jewish aggression in the realm of political revolutionism. It is not a small wing in itself. Certainly, it does not become smaller by its connection with the Kehilla, nor the Kehilla by its gain of these workers. The two unions mentioned above number over 337,000 members. That figure is conservative. Besides these, there are associated with the Kehilla the members of 1,000 other Jewish organizations, such as synagogues, charitable societies, and educational bodies, and 100,000 individual members who belong on their own account. Link this organization with the powerful American Jewish Committee, and at once the protest of the editors and the spokesmen of the Kehilla is a weak... As a weak, unimportant body becomes a deliberate falsehood. And as for those Gentile fronts who are ready victims of Gentile propaganda, and who, without personal knowledge, are describing the Kehilla as a large and flourishing charitable society, bad teamwork there, let them read in the next article what some of the Kehilla leaders are trying to do to the United States.
Well, you finished that very nicely. 16th April, 1921. Okay, well, what kind of comments do you have on this, Hadding?
Well, I recall that Samuel Untermeyer was supposed to have been, who was on the, he says that Samuel Untermeyer was on the American Jewish Committee and also on that New York Kehilla. Untermeyer was the one that supposedly paid off Woodrow Wilson's secret debt to the mother of his illegitimate son that kept her quiet. Mm. And also left Wilson open to pressure from his creditor.
Exactly the same as with, well, not exactly, but the same as with Churchill.
Similar thing with Churchill.
Getting his debts paid off.
Yeah, similar thing with Churchill.
And how many others? I mean, this behind the scenes, and I think that this chapter has inspired me to talk about that there should be a group. We should have some group of researchers and writers and spokespeople who will go into all these details about that show what the Jews have been up to and what they're doing, and make it public and describe it in a way as well as they do here, maybe even better, you know, for today's people, you know, why the Jews are a problem. I mean, I just don't think people are getting it. And I know you have to have access to people, but, you know, don't you think that would be a good idea if we had a kind of a factor that was involved in that?
Assembling information about this?
Yes, and making it, presenting
it. As regards foreign policy, I think people are more aware than ever of Jewish influence. You know, we've got Professor McDonald, at least as one guy, putting together some information about Jewish influence domestically.
Right. Well, I think we could do a better job of it. We could get into more detail and spell it out as clearly as possible so that people cannot say, well, that they're just, you know, they're just smart or they're just good at that or something. You know,
well, sure. Got to have those ready-made counter-arguments.
Well, they do. Well, it looks like our time is up for tonight. So thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in. And we will be back next week for more about the labor union.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.